Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you for everyone that's here. We have a few bills for possible or measures for possible introduction. Let's go ahead and take care of those first. Aaron?
All right. Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. We have multiple LCs before us today for possible introduction. First, LC 3232, dated 2/14/11. Second, LC 3232-1. Dated 2/14/11, LC 3291-1, dated 2/11/11, LC 3308, dated 2/2/11, and finally LC 3486, dated 1/25/11.
Chair, take a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt LC 3232, LC 3232-1, LC 3291, LC 3291-1, LC 3308, and LC 3486 as bills of the Senate Committee on Judiciary.
All right. Senator Bonamici has moved that we introduce for possible consideration measures LC 3232, 3232-1, 3291, 3291-1, 3308, and 3486. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And just for the record, since we haven't done this week, that should be on the record that individuals supporting the introduction of these measures is only getting into the process. There's no guarantee that any of us would actually be supporting the bill if and when that gets a hearing in this committee or any other committee, or if it makes it to the floor. So with that, we're going to go ahead and start our public hearings, and we're going to start with one of the top of the list, Senate Bill 373.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 373 is a modification to the requirements for filing with the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee. Basically, this changes the present requirements, which are paper requirements, to an electronic filing system in accordance with rules adopted by the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. It would remove the obligation of forfeiture counsel to provide AFOAC with any other copy. The proponents of the bill requested that I give a somewhat more expansive technical overview, so I would note that they would argue that all counties are currently capable of processing electronic information within the existing OGIN system, the official website of the Register of Actions and Judgment Records for the State of Oregon Judicial Department, and that this filing system is duplicative and in their eyes creates crates and crates of unneeded storage.
All right, and as a member of the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee, this is something that was taken up through that committee process, and based on the review of the committee and input, it was determined that going electronically would be a much more efficient and effective way for all of those involved. And because of the time constraints on staff, we do not have anyone here from the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, but I do want to ask if there's anyone here who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 373. Not seeing anyone run up to the top, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 373. And now we're into Senate Bill 396.
There. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 396 modifies multiple portions of existing statutes. Essentially, it does two different things. First of all, presently, if a sheriff wants to serve a copy of a protective order, there are a variety of ways they can do it, including by fax, but the statute hasn't caught up with all methods of electronic service or electronic communication, such as PDF. This would expand the sheriff's ability to make service of copies that were furnished electronically. It also incorporates language from the existing Family Abuse and Protection Act into other portions of the statute, outlining that when an individual is being accompanied to their home or a domicile from which they're about to be restrained, they're given 20 minutes to gather personal effects, which are outlined within the proposed statute, and they are given only one opportunity to do this within that 20-minute time period. Presently, that language does not exist within the statute, and there is no guidance given to peace officers accompanying these individuals as to the scope or nature of the effects to be gathered.
All right, thank you. We have three individuals that have signed up on the registration. I'll ask all three to come up as a panel. Brian Wallace, Marshall Ross, and Sybil Hebb. And while they're coming up, is there going to be anyone else who'd like to give testimony on 396? I'll let you go in whatever order you'd like to do. If you just put your name on the record so we can have that and proceed, please.
Okay. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Wallace. I'm the Chief Civil Supervisor at the Marion County Sheriff's Office and currently the President of the Oregon Sheriff's Civil Command Council. Each session, we usually bring a few technical fixes to the legislature, so I thank you for the opportunity to do this once more. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 396. Written testimony has been submitted to be a part of the official record by my colleague and I. We'd like to run through the sections of this bill real quick. Keep in mind that these are changes in the Family Abuse Prevention Act, elder abuse, and juvenile dependency restraining orders, as well as stalking protective orders. So for the purposes of this testimony, we'll refer to them as protection orders as a whole. That way we speed things up. Sections 1, 5, 6, and 7 of this bill allows a sheriff to immediately enter into the law enforcement data system maintained by the state police a protection order when the sheriff receives any notice from a city police department who has served one. This is helpful until an affidavit of service can be signed and submitted by that serving officer. It proves difficult for some local police agencies to drive all the way to the sheriff's office to sign an affidavit, especially when they're busy with calls for service, and sometimes these city police officers are the only one on duty in their city. So this allows us to essentially get verbal notification from the police officer in order to forthwith enter that restraining order or protective order into the law enforcement data system. Some believe that as the statute is currently constructed, you have to first wait until an affidavit is signed by the serving law enforcement member before entry. It also allows for the service of a protection order by a member of a law enforcement agency, which could be a clerk at the front counter of a sheriff's office, if a deputy is not in the office at that time. And it could also be a probation officer. It creates faster service, which creates a safer environment for a petitioner and a quicker opportunity for a respondent who wishes to request a hearing. Sections 2, 4, 7, and 8 of the bill allow a sheriff to serve a copy of a protected order if it's transmitted electronically. Previously, we were restricted to being able to serve a copy, a faxed copy. As we all know, sometimes faxes don't transmit very legibly. So this would allow us to receive a PDF file, which is a lot more clear and kind of gets with the times. And that also aligns itself with the new eCourt project, so that's a good thing. And finally, before I turn over to my colleague here, Section 7 also has new language that was mentioned by counsel that now aligns itself with the Family Abuse Prevention Act as it pertains to standing by while a respondent removes their personal effects when they're ordered to move from a residence. So we're not creating necessarily anything new. We're aligning it with elder abuse and the Family Abuse Prevention Act. At this point, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Deputy Ross with Multnomah County, and I'd be happy to take questions at the end of our testimony. Thank you.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Marshall Ross. I'm a senior deputy with the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, and I supervise the Sheriff's Civil Unit. Continuing on in explaining 396 as we've proposed, Section 3 allows a sheriff to serve a modification of less restrictions of a family abuse prevention order simply by mailing it to the respondent and allowing us to immediately enter those conditions of less restrictions into the law enforcement data system. Legislature created the ability for a petitioner to obtain a modification to their own restraining order that loosens up restrictions which can expand visitation, change custody, or expand on the contact that the petitioner and the respondent can have. But we had no guidance as to the method of service. So we've had to personally serve these before we enter these conditions of less restrictions into the law enforcement data system. This created kind of a catch-22 scenario, because the parties often walk out of court and start abiding by their terms of less restrictions immediately. We have had instances where a respondent has been arrested doing what they believe they legally can, but they haven't been served and it hasn't been recorded. And a police officer must effect a mandatory arrest based upon the information that they receive from the law enforcement data system. So that will eliminate that scenario from happening. It also speeds up our service, as we're not chasing down people on a purely paperwork issue. We're able to focus our resources on serving the original restraining orders to protect the victims of domestic violence. Thank you for the opportunity to appear today, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
All right, before we take questions, Sybil, why don't you go ahead and give us your presentation.
Thank you. Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, also in support of Senate Bill 396. As you know, the Law Center provides free legal assistance to low-income Oregonians, and a significant percentage of our clients, unfortunately, suffer from domestic violence. So the restraining order process and the implementation of that process is very important to us. We appreciate the efforts of my co-testifiers and have really appreciated the ability to look at this language and consult with them in months previous to this presentation. So we think that the changes here are technical, practical amendments that will facilitate the ease with which orders can be served, speed the process up, and that contributes to victim safety. So we're appreciative of that. And the standby provisions that were referred to in Chapter 419B, refer to a type of restraining order that can be entered in juvenile court that does not currently have any standby provisions, and it's important for both victims as well as the alleged perpetrator here to be able to have some process by which they understand how they will retrieve belongings from the house of residence. So we think that's a good change, and we appreciate the work. So thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions? All right. Let's see, Deputy Ross, I just want to put something on the record as to what you said, just make sure we're all on the same page. I understand that the new process would allow for orders that give, let's say, broader or less restrictions, let's just stay with the terms you had used, can be served by mail. I'm assuming that if some type of, let's say, more restrictive restrictions are going to be imposed on someone, they still need to be personally served?
Chair Prezanski, members of the committee. That is correct, sir. Restraining orders, modifications, less restrictions. Anything that changes any other provision of the restraining order would require personal service. We have to be able to establish that for any prosecution of the violation.
Right. Great. Thank you. I just want to get that on the record. Any other comments? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick question about the same provision, and I'm trying to figure it out in the text. Maybe you could just answer it. You said that sometimes parties walk out of court thinking that the provisions apply, but now it has to be served. So does this allow service by email or just by regular mail?
Chair Prezanski, Senator Bonamici, the answer to the question is it will be a service by the sheriff mailing it to the respondent, and when we mail it, then we can immediately enter it into the law enforcement data system. The courts transmit these, in my county, the courts transmit these orders to the sheriff daily, right after the hearing times. So it will be nearly contemporaneous that we're able to do the mailing, get it into the law enforcement data system, and update the terms of the entire restraining order.
Thank you.
Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, Senator Bonamici, I would just add also that if the order recites that the respondent was present in court at that hearing, then the necessity of service is waived, so it can be sort of instantaneous at that point. So.
Questions or comments? Thank you very much for coming forward. And I'll ask once again, does anyone else want to give testimony on Senate Bill 396? I'm not seeing. We'll close that public hearing. And we'll move into our next public hearing, which will be Senate Bill 404.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. A little background on Senate Bill 404. Currently, ORS 14.210 outlines the various bases on which sitting judges are obligated to recuse themselves. Under existing law, a judge is obligated to recuse themselves if they have a relationship of blood or affinity to the attorney, either attorney who's trying the case, but also if they have a relationship of blood or affinity to the partners or associates at a law firm of the attorney who is trying the case. Senate Bill 404 would remove that provision, making it appropriate for a judge to sit when that kind of a connection exists, again, when they don't have a relationship of blood or affinity to the attorney trying the case, but somebody else in their firm or organization.
All right, thank you. Pete Shepherd. Pete, come on up. And while Pete's getting settled, is there going to be anyone else who will want to give testimony on Senate Bill 404? Pete?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pete Shepherd. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Harang, Long, Gary, Rudnick. And I'm here to testify to represent the firm and to testify in support of Senate Bill 404. To ensure impartiality, 42 states, the federal courts, the United States Supreme Court, the Oregon Code of Judicial Conduct, and the American Bar Association's Model Rules of Judicial Conduct all provide for the mandatory disqualification of a judge when he or she is related to a lawyer personally participating in the proceeding before the judge. Senate Bill 404 addresses a statute that is unnecessarily inconsistent with that prevailing rule. In Oregon, as your counsel has summarized, ORS 14.210 requires disqualification not only where the judge is related to the attorneys personally participating, but also where the judge is related to a different lawyer employed by the same firm. So, for example, the participating lawyer's firm may have an overseas office in Hong Kong, that in which office a distant relative of the judge is employed by the same firm. Under the rule applicable in the federal courts, the United States Supreme Court, and 42 other states, that judge is not subject to mandatory disqualification, though the judge still and the parties still are able to achieve a disqualification if there is actual bias or prejudice to the parties to the proceeding before the judge.
In Oregon, however, for that judge is subject under the statute of questions mandatory
disqualification. The statute, of course, as counsel summarized and as I've described, is independent of the actuality of any bias or impartiality on the part of the judge. Statute harms the public interest in two ways, both of which are cured by by Senate Bill 404. First, it requires disqualification of well-qualified judges and impartial judges from matters in which there's no actuality of bias, and thus deprives Oregonians of the benefit of the judgment and wisdom of the judges in question. And second, it unfairly limits the employment opportunities of new lawyers because knowing of that disqualification rule, a firm that is looking to hire a lawyer who is distantly related to some judge may find that a portion of its practice is impaired by the fact that the judge would have to recuse him or herself from proceedings in which any member of the firm made an appearance, even if the new lawyer were not him or herself making the appearance. So with that background, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would simply urge your approval of the bill, and I'm prepared to answer questions about it.
Great, thank you. Questions?
I have a question.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Shepherd. Is this, I know the statute's been around for a while. Is this, what's the problem that the bill is trying to solve? Have there been instances where there's been a problem?
Chair, Senator Bonamici, the first statute has been around a long time, 70-some years as nearly as we can determine. The direct answer to your question is I don't know of a case in which we can't find a case in which the statute has been cited, for example, or been an issue, its interpretation been an issue in any proceeding. And I've reflected on that. One, potentially unflattering interpretation for lawyers is that no lawyer ever noticed the reach of the statute and applied it. I think the more likely explanation for why we don't have a particular appellate case, for example, to use to focus your attention, is that even with the passage of the bill, there will be significant and very robust protections against partial or biased action. The statutes will still permit any party, for example, to raise a question of actual bias, whether it arises from a relationship of the judge to a lawyer or to a lawyer's partner or associate in the same firm. And I think, Senator, that in my experience of, before the courts in Oregon, that the reason we don't see this statute cited is that cases of real bias or even concerns, substantial concerns about bias, are identified by the parties and the judges on their own and don't become issues that would give rise to the application of the statute. The particular reason that it came to our attention is that our firm employs a young and very bright, very able associate who has a relative whose father is a judge in the Oregon court system. That's how we became aware of the statute on our own. And since then, since we've discovered it, we've realized that there are a number of other judges who have lawyers in their extended families who would be affected by the statute.
And did you say that this brings the Oregon law in line with the Code of Judicial Conduct?
It does. It both with the American Bar Association Model Code and with the existing Oregon Code of Judicial Conduct.
Can I ask one more follow-up, please, Mr. Chair? And this doesn't just apply to the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, but to all trial courts?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, that's correct. The statute actually refers specifically to a judge, and the subsequent statute in the same series, 14.250, applies specifically to circuit judges. So I would interpret the statute as applying to all judges.
Thank you,
Senator Wissett.
Mr. Shepard, as I read the judicial canons, it's my understanding, and I'm certainly not an attorney, but it's my understanding that the judge or justice actually has the ability to determine whether there's a conflict of interest, and if he believes there's a conflict of interest, he should recuse himself. Otherwise, he only needs to alert the participants in the action that he could have a potential conflict of interest. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsett, under the code, there are circumstances that direct the judge to exercise the recusal to recuse him or herself. There are circumstances under which the judge let's start there. What the rule provides is that a judge shall disqualify himself or herself in a proceeding in which the judge's impartiality reasonably may be questioned, including but not limited to instances when, and then the applicable circumstance here is the judge, the judge's spouse, parent or child, wherever residing, or any other person residing in the judge's household, is a party to the proceeding or is acting as a lawyer in the proceeding. And then, Senator, to follow up on your question, what the rule further provides is that a judge who is disqualified under the rule that I've just described, rather than withdrawing, may choose to disclose the nature of the conflict on the record, and then if the parties all agree on the record or in writing that the judge may continue to sit, then that's permissible. But what that really does, in effect, is it
effectively cedes to the parties then the authority to determine whether the judge
will continue regardless of the conflict.
If I may follow up. I would respectfully suggest that's probably not a bad idea the way it's written currently.
I don't see that we have
the judicial branch here to testify. It would certainly be helpful, I think, for me and maybe for members of the committee to know where the judicial branch stands on this, whether they want something like this to occur or not. Quite frankly, it appears to me that the situation is already handled. I mean, if someone really believes that the judge is, for a better word, tainted because of some relationship within a firm, then probably the judge should recuse himself. And if the parties agree that it's not a problem, then it's not a problem.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I think it is a problem, and let me take another run at explain why. The bill will not change the rule that you and I both favor in the Code of Judicial Conduct. Those rules will remain in place, and a judge will have to follow those rules when they apply. So when the lawyer appearing in the particular proceeding is related in the way described in the rules, then the judge will, after the bill and currently, would be obligated to recuse him or herself and or to notify the parties and permit them to exercise their authority under the rule. So those rules will remain in place. The problem is that overlaid on top of those rules is this unique Oregon mandatory disqualification statute, the statute that would be amended by the rule, by the bill. And so the problem, Senator Whitsitt, is not that there isn't a very good and very robust protection in Oregon law, in the rules of judicial conduct and elsewhere in the statutes for that matter, to protect parties against the potential or even really the substantial risk of bias or partiality in the proceedings, but rather that the statute in question extends to an extent that is really unrelated to any possibility, really any logical possibility of any conflict or problem. So, and that it's that extension, that overlay of this very unique Oregon statute that does present the problem.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just might also like to know where the Oregon State Bar has a position on this.
Okay, we'll see. We'll find out.
I don't see them here. Thank you.
So my understanding, and Pete, just to kind of, I guess, rehash this, is that at this point there's an automatic disqualification based on some distance relative that's attached to a law firm when that law firm is going to appear in front of the judge, even though the relative may not have any direct involvement in the case and may be some distance in relations and working in an office that's in, say, not in the same city jurisdiction of where the case is actually being held.
That's so, Mr. Chair.
All right. Anything else? Thank you very much for coming forward. Let me ask one more time. Does anyone else today want to give testimony on Senate Bill 404? Not seeing anyone. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing. And we're going to now move into a public hearing on Senate Bill 414. Aaron?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 414 pertains to small estates. Those are defined by statutes as being estates of $275,000 or less. And if an individual dies with some creditors and they fall under that category, they're subject to ORS 114535, which details, sort of in combination with other portions of adjacent statutes, the process of obtaining an affidavit to give the creditor access to the estate of the deceased person. This bill proposes to expand that access in a couple of different ways, one of which it would impose an affirmative obligation on the holder of the property to provide access and to allow the bearer of the affidavit to take possession of the property. And it would also expand the scope of the property to be examined or seized to include safety deposit boxes.
All right, thank you. I've got two people, it looks like they want to give testimony. Kevin Christensen and Marianne, is it Besson? Will there be anyone else who will want to give testimony on Senate Bill 414?
Shepard's Jaworski, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Christensen. I am the Government Affairs Director for the Oregon Bankers Association, and we are here today in support of Senate Bill of 414. With me to my left is Assistant Vice President of Pioneer Trust Bank, Marianne Vicente, who will be giving the bulk of our testimony. As the Administrator noted, this is essentially a technical cleanup of a bill dealing with small estates affidavits, and in general, these are states less than $275,000, as indicated. Probably the key point that we're dealing with right now are safe deposit boxes and sums in those safe deposit boxes that are, you know, you can't have to actually use the small estates affidavit. The personal property involved can't exceed $75,000. So we're talking about some fairly limited estate issues here. And essentially, we look at this as a technical fix to clean up and clarify for purposes of our banks when and when personal property found inside a safe deposit box can be provided to the affiant when it's provided. So with that, I turn it over to Marianne to give some additional testimony.
Chair Prusansky, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Vicente, and as you said, I'm Assistant Vice President at Pioneer Trust Bank. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Bankers Association in support of Senate Bill 414. This bill resolves a problem banks frequently face when following the death of a customer that has a safe deposit box. In many cases, the customer's estate is small enough that it can be administered under the estate provision of ORS Chapter 114. These limits are not more than $75,000 in personal property and not more than $200,000 in real property. Under the small estate provision, certain persons, such as the descendant's surviving spouse, can sign and file a small estate affidavit, which enables that person to take possession of the decedent's property, pay any of the bills, and distribute whatever is left under the will or by law.
Existing ORS 114.535 provides when a person such as a bank is indebted to the descendant or has possession of personal property belonging to the decedent's estate and the person is presented with a small estate affidavit, it is to pay the debt and deliver the personal property to whoever presents the affidavit. The problem is when this statute is applied to a decedent's property in a safe deposit box. The statute as now written doesn't work. And this is because under law, the bank does not have possession of the personal property in the box. It's much like when an owner rents out property, a house or apartment, the property in that house belongs to the tenant and is in their possession. The same as with the safe deposit box. It is rented by the customer. So, in the case of the safe deposit box, it neither authorizes nor directs to turn the property over. Senate Bill 414 would resolve this problem by amending ORS 114.535 and corresponding sections in Chapter 708A and 723 to provide that if a small estate affidavit is delivered to a person that controls access to personal property belonging to the decedent, the person is to give access to the property to the person presenting the affidavit and also allow that person to take the possession of the property. Now, the only situation where the bank would not be allowed to turn over the property is if the bank is aware and it makes apparent that the property inside the box exceeds the $75,000 limit. At that point, it would be too large to be under the small estate provisions. At that point, the bank would by law be required to inventory the property. They would retain the property and they would keep the original of the inventory and provide a copy of the inventory to the person providing the small estate affidavit. Disposition of the box contents at that point would then be handled through probate or an intestate proceeding. The availability of small estate process allows small estates to be administered without incurring the expense or delay of probate or intestate proceedings. Enactment of Senate Bill 414 will remove an important obstacle to the use of small estate affidavits in cases where the descendant left personal property in a safe deposit box. Thank you, Senator Prusansky, committee members. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right, great. Thank you. Questions? Senator Wissett first.
As I understand this, this would allow creditors access to the decedent's safety deposit box, and someone in the bank would decide whether the amount of the contents of that box was in value of it was in excess of the of the amount that on the affidavit. Who in the bank would make that decision? What would be their qualifications to make that decision? Would it be a bank teller? Would it be someone who just handles the keys to the safe deposit box? How would you determine? And also, how would you determine that the creditor who had the affidavit in his hand would be provided the legal authority to acquire the property? But how would you decide? Who's going to decide that?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Whitsitt, I think I'll let Marianne speak with her bank specific. I think that's going to be an internal decision as to who is that designant. There are a couple of issues. First of all, with respect to the small estate affidavit, the affidavit itself is going to need to be filed, as I understand it, with the probate court 30 days in advance. And again, this is a sworn statement that's made under oath by the affiant. After that 30-day period runs, then they can go to a financial institution, bank, and say, here's the sworn affidavit with respect to the estate itself. They then approach the bank. The bank, through its normal procedures, and it's my presumption, although I can't say definitively who that person is, designated person would be, my guess is it would probably be beyond the teller level. It's not going to be someone kind of rank and file. What they would do is open up the safe deposit box and examine the contents. If it's clear that the contents are within or rather below the $75,000 threshold, the contents are then turned over. If they're not, the bank, according to the statute, and I think it's Section 2 and 3, Subsection 8 of the provision, says that the bank is to inventory the property, and then you go back to the probate court with respect to clarifying, and basically has to run through the probate system itself. So the final piece that is incorporated into this, and I would direct you to Subsection 9, Section 2, Subsection 9, and Section 3, Subsection 9. With respect to the bank, that if a bank does make a valuation, the bank does not face liability for the valuation issue with respect to it. And I'm not sure if Marianne can add some clarity.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Whitsitt, yes, he is correct that a teller would not be the person that would assist with that. In our institution, I can't speak for other banks. Obviously, it would be someone of my level or possibly higher. You know, we take very good care of these types of situations.
Is that somewhere in the statute?
I'm not aware that it is,
no.
Senator.
So this person, whatever level in the bank, would then be able to determine whether a stone was a CZ or a diamond or a historical document had great value or was just a piece of paper?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Whitsitt, as the bill is constructed or written right now, the bank makes a valuation, and if there is a question, the bank is supposed to take an inventory of what is in the box, and then essentially the inventory is given. Possession of the contents are not provided to the affiant requesting them.
And if there is no question that the contents of the box is given to the affiant, and there's no liability on the part of the bank for providing whatever the value was?
I believe that's correct.
Thank you.
Other questions? All right. Kevin, just a couple things for clarity. First of all, if someone presents this document at a bank, Marianne, for you as well, and the box is determined to have assets, and let's say there's no dispute under $75,000, how does the bank know what, if anything, in the way of real property is owned to know whether or not we're getting to a larger estate based on the amount of what the value of the real property is so great that it would put it over the top?
Chair Brzezinski, excuse me, I don't have an answer to that. I'm presuming that the diligent attorney is going to make that clear in the affidavit overall that they're filing with the court, but I don't have a specific answer to that.
And then the other question, I guess, is the proposal that we have before us, an SB 414, can you give us some history as to how that if this is a common model rule that's used in other states, or is this something unique or would be unique for us as a state?
Chair Brzezinski, I'm not sure as far as other states. We were approached by a couple of our institutions who had issues when you had what I think would be considered de minimis amounts inside a safe deposit box, and the inability of the institutions to turn those over. And so what we've tried to do, at least within this, I don't believe our council has crafted this on a model rule in other states, but what we were trying to do with respect to this is to devise a means to address that situation. Okay. In which the contents are below. Again, we're looking at the situation in which there is relative de minimis value in the box and being able to expedite the situation. Right. May I ask one other clarifying question? Oh, no, I'll come back to that.
Okay. So I guess the only other part on this is just making sure, and hearing the questions that Senator Wissett has put forward as to if you have someone let's say there is a will, and so you do have people who are supposed to be receiving something under the will as to making certain that there is the, appropriate handling of whatever's remaining in the estate. I guess the concerns that I'm hearing and would have some point to make certain that a creditor, so what I'm hearing or what I think I understand is that if the creditor has an outstanding debt from the estate, that they could actually take the value of whatever's within the security deposit box and offset to it against whatever debt is still owed through the estate. Is that correct?
I believe so. Mm-hmm.
All right. And I guess the other part on that is it doesn't have a clarification as to what Senator Wissett also asked, is if you have personal papers which they may not have any value per se for the creditor, but could have, some type of human emotional tie, something to the family. If all of the box is going to be given, or contents of the box is going to be given to the creditor, is there any obligation on the creditor to provide those type of documents that have no monetary value to the family, or whoever might be at decedent?
Chair Brzezinski, you're talking if we took away or didn't move forward with this person. I don't know the answer to that, in all honesty. That's something I would follow up with. I don't.
Yeah. But, on a personal perspective, on our security safety deposit box, we have multiple things in there, and some of them have no monetary value per se, but for family, they could mean a lot.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so what I thought I heard from the testimony is that if the creditor presents the affidavit, the bank goes through its process, everything seems to be appropriate, that the contents of the box is given to the creditor if they meet the obligations under the affidavit, etc. And if that's the case, then what happens to these, let's say, personal belongings that have no value for the creditor?
And perhaps I'm Chair Brzezinski, perhaps I'm misunderstanding. Are you talking about if this goes into place, you have these items in the box?
Yes.
And if this goes into place, then my understanding is those items would be turned over with the understanding that if the value, if it's apparent from the materials that it sees, it's below the $75,000 threshold, then those would be turned over under this regime. So.
Right. So there's no safeguard, which is what I'm hearing, as to any personal effects that have little to no value for the creditor who's just received those contents.
Senator Brzezinski, I'm sorry. I guess I'm not quite following, because it seems, and perhaps we're talking a bit
across
purposes.
Let's say I have photographs in mm-hmm. the family heritage photographs that are in that safety deposit box. There's also other items of value.
Mm-hmm.
The value of whatever's in that safety deposit box is under $75,000. Mm-hmm. The creditor gets everything, from what I'm hearing, that's in the contents of that. There's no dividing out what's monetary or to say some type of monetary value versus keepsakes that really don't have any value to the creditor. If the bank is going to give everything that's in that safety deposit box to this creditor, mm-hmm. what, if any, obligations is there for the creditor to pass along to whoever's in the will those type of keepsakes?
Mm-hmm. Representative Brzezinski, that's something I don't have an answer to. I'm going to look in.
All right. Senator Wissett.
Just one further question. Does this apply only to safety deposit boxes held by banks, or does it also include credit unions or other securities?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Wissett, it does. If you look at Section 3, it concerns credit unions as well.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Chair Brzezinski, I would be happy to follow up after the committee with both the chair and also Senator Wissett to clarify some of the issues that have been raised.
That would be great. And if you actually, if you put something in writing, if you can just get it to staff, that way everyone can get it, because I think everyone will probably want to know what the answers are.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. So is there anyone else who would like to give testimony today on Senate Bill 414? All right, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 414. And we're going to open up our last public hearing, I believe we have for the day, which is on Senate Bill 516.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 516 governs the rate of interest to be applied for judgments for payment of money. Current ORS 82.010 designates 9% per annum as the default legal rate of interest to be paid on contracts and agreements within certain categories, but does not include either court-mandated mediation or arbitration. This bill would bring those two categories under the purview of the 9% interest default figure.
All right, thank you. We have a number of people who'd like to give testimony today on 516. What I'm going to do is bring up a panel of those who are in favor, and then we'll follow with those who are against, then I have at least one person neutral. So the ones I'm calling up for in favor, Ed Reeves, I believe it's Nick Slotty, and Angela Martin. Oh, well, they're going to come up.
Okay. Mr. Chair, can I say a few words since this is...
The three I've called up, come on up and get set. And then as we get situated, we're going to allow Senator Dingfelder to make some opening comments as she introduces the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since my name is on the bill, I thought I should explain why it's before this committee. First, I became aware of lending and debt collection practices through my work on the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, and I consider this bill a continuation of the work that I've done with advocates in this building on payday loans, car title loans, check cashing fees, consumer credit interest rates. I think we worked on that several sessions ago. Many thanks go to Angela Martin, who you're going to hear from today, and others who have brought this issue to my attention. And the bill will set a reasonable interest rate on debt collection judgments or mediated settlement. As you're going to hear from several speakers today who can talk more in depth about the bill, but I appreciate having it up on the agenda.
Thank you. All right. Whoever wants to start off, if you just identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. My name is Richard Slotty. I'm a professor at Lewis and Clark Law School, but my primary job is directing the Lewis and Clark Legal Clinic, which is one of the teaching clinics for the law school. And in my role as director, I've represented a lot of low-income debtors in consumer issues, debt problems, and Chapter 7 bankruptcy. So I've, over the years, have become familiar with the particular problems that low-income Oregonians have in the financial area. What interested me about this bill when I first saw it was that it actually reflects the fundamental change in the relationship that, between a creditor and a debtor that occurs once a lawsuit has been filed and a judgment has been obtained, particularly as to the interest rate that has been applied. At the start of the relationship between the creditor and the debtor, between the borrower and the borrower and the lender, the seller and the buyer, they come up with an interest rate, and that interest rate is determined by a couple of factors. For the creditor, for the lender, it's based on negotiation power. Obviously, it's supposed to reflect the risk of extending credit to the buyer, to the borrower, and it is some compensation for the lending money, selling property, not getting a fair return right away. For the borrower, it's also negotiation power, although for the low-income debtor, that negotiation power is often much less than for the creditor. And there's an incentive, not only to get the credit, but to pay the credit and not default, and if they default, to get back on track again because of accruing interest. Well, once a judgment is entered, a lawsuit is filed, particularly for the low-income debtor, that relationship changes. The creditor now has a wide variety of collection efforts. They can garnish wages, they can execute on property, they can impose liens. The accruing interest is really no longer part of the equation. It's not part of the risk any longer because that risk has already been taken. It's not part of the compensation. The creditor has gotten attorney's fees, they've gotten court costs, they've got all the accruing interest that has accrued up to the date of the judgment. And for me, probably even more important is at the start of the transaction, the parties may not have even contemplated the rate of interest that would accrue after a judgment was entered. That would not have to be in the contract. That interest would accrue at a particular rate after the judgment was entered, as long as there was a rate of interest specified in the contract. There's certainly some unjust or astonishing, I guess would be a better word, results that can be seen from continuing the pre-judgment contract rate to a post-judgment situation. If you take a look at page 2 of the testimony that I submitted, I gave you some examples of how, I gave you 5 examples of how pre-judgment contract rate of interest translates into a post-judgment interest rate, and you can see at least for some of those that the interest rate that accrues post-judgment has absolutely no reasonable relation to the original debt. Now, some of those, particularly number 2, where you end up with about $186,000 in interest over 20 years based on a $5,000 contract where it's compounded annually, probably don't see that very often. Certainly a judgment that's been in effect for 10 years, much less 20 years, probably would have been collected, or the debtor may well have filed bankruptcy prior to that time. But that result is possible under the current statute. If you look farther down the list, you can see some that may be a little more realistic, but still show you the results that can happen under a contract that allows for pre-contract interest to continue. How does this affect the low-income debtors? Well, they're the ones who are typically paying the 26, 29, 30, 36% interest rate because they simply don't have the negotiating power. They don't have the built-up credit history to negotiate a lower interest rate as would more affluent debtors or buyers and more affluent businesses. So I think it's a fair for both the consumer and for the creditors to impose what would be considered a reasonable interest rate, and the legislature has already determined that 9% is a reasonable rate. In fact, it's a fantastic rate considering our current economy on post-judgment interest. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Whoever's going to go next.
Okay, hi. My name is Ed Reeves. I've been a corporate labor and employment attorney at a major law firm in Oregon for the past 27 years. For the last 6 or so years, I've been an arbitrator in Multnomah County Circuit Court and volunteered as a mediator in Multnomah County Small Claims Court. It's my experience as an arbitrator and mediator in debt collection cases that has brought me here today in support of Senate Bill 516. Yes.
Instead of reading your testimony, if you could summarize it since we do have it.
Absolutely.
That'd be
great. I'm also offering the written testimony of Judith Chambliss, which you have there, and I can do that, who is the recently retired coordinator of the mediation program in Multnomah County Circuit Court, the Small Claims Court. She could not be here today. Briefly, in her testimony, she talks about her 20 years of experience as working with the Multnomah County Small Claims Court as a mediator and as a director of that program. She points out that the number of collection cases has swollen the Small Claims Court docket so that we now have Small Claims Court 4 days instead of 3. And she specifically points out that where in the past perhaps 10 or 12% of the cases that were heard in Small Claims Court were debt collection cases, that number has tripled in recent years. while many of those cases are cases for things like unpaid medical bills, where the interest rate that's sought by the debt collector is only 9%, there's an increasing number of cases where these very high interest rate cases, where people are asking not only for some mediated agreement or a judgment, but are asking for the continuation of interest rates as high as 30 or 36%. And in the rest of her testimony, her written testimony, she talks about the impact that those kind of collection cases have on the court system. My observations are more as an arbitrator and a mediator who gets to deal with these kind of cases. When you are in a mediated case where the interest rate is 9%, people are looking for a way to solve the problem. People are looking for a way to get the bills paid and to get this debt completed. When you're dealing with debts that are at 30 or 36% interest, the interest of the creditor, both in mediation and at judgment, is to see that debt continue, to see the compounding of the high interest rate because of the windfall that results as a consequence of the compounding of these 30 or 36% interest rates. And so the mediations that I participate in as a mediator are very different when we're talking high interest rate. The goal is a very different goal. Similarly, when something is reduced to judgment, whether it's because a mediated agreement is not fulfilled or because they actually proceed to judgment, that opens up new options for the creditor through, as has been pointed out, garnishments or attachment of property. But both of those incidents take much more time than the perception of the original $2,000 debt or whatever, because we limit garnishments in this state to a percentage of disposable income, which means that over time the payments are going to take much longer than initially anticipated, and the interest rate will compound. Similarly, if you attach property, that payment isn't made until the property is sold. So if you hold on to the property for another decade and only execute on the judgment at that point, the compounding of the interest rate will be for that decade. I want to point out that this bill does not restrict the ability to offer or enter into these high interest loans in Oregon. What it does do is it levels the playing field when the parties seek court-activated judgments or mediated agreements in order to compel payment of the debts. And I think that it's that level playing field that we're hoping for.
All right. Thank you. Angela.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Angela Martin with Economic Fairness Oregon, a nonprofit focused on consumer advocacy. Much has already been said, so I will summarize my comments. Well, starting with simply the background of many facts that have contributed to the increase in debt collection cases. Those are both economic and industry trends that have contributed to the rise in both debt collection cases and the number of consumer credit accounts falling into default. Just prior to the recession in early 2006, we see that the charge-off rates on consumer loans was under 3%. By 2010, the charge-off rates was more than 6%, again, leaving more delinquent accounts in collection status. The industry trends that we're noting is an increase in firms that specialize in purchasing distressed debt, often for near pennies on the dollar. The largest five publicly traded debt buyers paid $835 billion to acquire $20 billion in old debt. Doing the math on that, it's about 4.2 cents on the dollar to purchase these accounts. The testimony that was submitted by Judith Chambliss speaks to the increased burden these collection cases have on our court systems. We also conducted an informal survey of court clerks across the state who all reported a similar rise in increased number of cases. Looking at cases in Multnomah County from 2008 to 2010, we find that the circuit court ruled on more than 6,000 collection cases. In addition to the concerns of the increased burden on the court, there's concerns about the increased burden on the consumer that these debt collection lawsuits bring. Last July, the Federal Trade Commission released a report after an extensive review concluding that the system for resolving consumer debt disputes was broken and in need of significant reform. Senate Bill 516 proposes just one fix that we believe is in need of reform, and that is the practice of plaintiffs seeking high interest rates, often two or four times higher than the state's 9% legal rate. It's worth mentioning that in both small claims and in circuit court, the vast majority of debt collection lawsuits are filed and resolved without a consumer's participation, resulting in an automatic win for the creditor. In Multnomah County, again, looking at those cases between 2008 and 2010, 95% of collection cases resulted in default judgments. This is in keeping with national trends. The result of this lack of consumer participation in these proceedings is a staggering number of default judgments on the past due debt that literally locks consumers into repayment at 20 to 36% interest. With my testimony, I included three cases to give you a sense of what these default judgments look like. The first case entered in July of 2001. The plaintiff is Portfolio Recovery Associates, a publicly traded debt buyer. A couple of things that we note about this. First off, the unpaid principal is $2,600 and some change. The prejudgment interest that accrued from November 2003 all the way to the date of judgment, July of 2009, is an additional $3,864. Senate Bill 516 does not speak to the ability of the creditor to collect these amounts of money. That would be left untouched. So on the total judgment of $6,500, under current law and under this judgment, the creditor was able to collect 25.9% interest, which after just a year would be $1,600 and some change. The next line, you can see what the Senate Bill 516 would do. That would bring that interest cost down to $585. The second case I included because this shows...
Angela, I'm going to need to take one more of the two because I've got a number of people that need to testify, and we have your written testimony.
Perfect. The second case, the thing I'd like to point out with this one is the high cost of mistakes that can occur with these default judgments that allow for high interest rates. In this particular case, not only is the principal awarded 20% interest post-judgment, but the attorney fees and court costs were also assigned 20% interest, which is not normally the case. We've heard about the tools that are offered to a creditor once a judgment is entered. I'm in agreement that those tools lower the risk for the creditor and create a big disparity between the risk that the creditor has and the payment interest rate that is often awarded. The final comments that I would like to make would speak to the need to address an amendment. It's been brought to my attention that the effective clause of this bill, there are some concerns. It's currently written that the this would be effective on all contracts signed after the effective date of this bill, and there are questions as to whether that's the appropriate way to address that. I would hope to work with Senator Dingfelder's office and the stakeholders to craft language that that better matches what we need.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. All right, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take Sam Sears' testimony next because he needs to be somewhere in about 12 minutes. So, Sam, why don't you come up, and then we'll pick up with Paul Cosgrove and Jim Marquis after that.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Sam Sears. I'm an attorney in private practice. I work in a small general practice firm. In the past, I've represented both creditors and debtors. I'm also chair of the Debtor-Creditor Legislative Committee for the Oregon State Bar, but I want to make clear that I'm here today on behalf, I'm not on behalf of that committee, but on my personal behalf. To raise a couple issues, or one issue really, that Ms. Martin actually ended on, and that's the applicability clause in Section 2 of this bill. As currently written, it applies to contracts entered into on or after the effective date of the Act. Through discussion with other attorneys, it came to my attention that could cause a couple problems and potentially some ambiguities, specifically on lines of credit or revolving credit contracts, such as credit cards, determining when the contract was entered into. I mean, I guess it's obvious that it was entered into on one particular date, but as for purposes of this act, would the applicability be that initial date, or would it renew at some point after different transactions were made? And I guess this could be seen in installment contracts as well, where a court may look at each new transaction in some cases as a new contract. In any event, there was some concern about the ambiguity that would cause. So one solution to that may be to tie the applicability of this bill to judgments that are entered into on or after the effective date of the act. Unfortunately, that potentially raises an issue of constitutionality, that it would impair contracts that were entered into before the date of the act. I personally don't think that would be an issue, but our committee specifically is working to vet that to make sure we didn't want to bring an amendment that had constitutional problems. So we're looking into that issue with more certainty in order to suggest that amendment. But that may be one way to solve that problem and take care of some of the ambiguities that could come up with the current way the bill is drafted.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Sam?
I just have a quick question. Hi, Sam. Do the contracts now, you're talking about on something like a line of credit, do the contracts now, I know they state, of course, the rate of interest during the time of the contract, but do they also have a provision that states the rate of interest post-judgment?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Bonamici, I don't know if there's a standard way that those contracts are written. I think it can vary, but my understanding would be that the contract rate would state whatever percentage it would be and not change whether it was pre or post judgment.
Thank you.
All right. One other question for myself, Sam. It sounds like he's the committee, and I assume you're talking about the committee that's associated with the State Bar. Is this an issue that is actually officially being taken up by the committee? The bill itself, or just the potential amendment?
We're in the process of bringing this amendment to going through the process to bring this amendment to this committee on behalf of the bar.
Okay.
But like I said, we hit some snags with that issue that we wanted to have it fully vetted before we went through. So it's not
fully appreciate that.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Anything else for Sam? Thank you very much. Safe travels to wherever you're going next.
Thank you, Chair.
All right, I've got two other people that are scheduled on the registration, Paul Cosgrove and Jim Marquis. Why don't y'all come forward? Is there anyone else who will want to give testimony on Senate Bill 516? Gentlemen, whoever wants to start off.
Thank you, Chair Krasinski. Members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing the Oregon Financial Services Association, and I'm appearing also on behalf of the United Financial Lobby, which is opposed to the bill. As you may have gathered, all of the concerns, questions, support, and opposition to the bill relates to actually just six or seven words, and I'd just like to highlight that. On page 1, line 28, it's the deletion of the words, the same rate provided in the contract, and substitution of the words 9%. What this does is, in lieu of the rate the parties agreed to post-judgment, post-arbitration award, etc., it substitutes the percentage of 9%, and that's the concern we have. I'd like to also just mention, I agree with Mr. Sears that there's concern about the effective date, but also point out that if you tied this to judgments, I think he's correct in his initial analysis, tying the effective date to a judgment entered thereafter would have the effect of impairing, modifying contracts that were pre-existing, and I think it does have a constitutional problem. But I'd like to just concentrate on those few words that I mentioned in lines 28 and 29. Most contracts that I'm familiar with, and I see an awful lot of them from my members, in fact, provide that the contract rate of interest is due and payable until the debt is paid off.
Right.
Whether that's paid off voluntarily in accordance with its terms, paid off late without a judgment, or paid off after judgment is entered. So in fact, although contracts, in my experience, do not say there's a rate before judgment or after judgment, some contracts do say there's a rate before default and after default, but rarely have I seen one that ties the interest rate change to judgment. They do make it clear that the rate is payable until it's paid. And I guess I would point out that I don't think, respectfully disagree with Professor Slaty about what is the risk that occurs after judgment is entered in terms of what effect that should have on the rate of interest. Frankly, in my experience, debts that have to go so far delinquent that they are actually resulting in a judgment are rarely collected, and in fact, or at least rarely fully collected. The risk of collection has in fact not decreased once judgment's entered, but in fact increased. So for those reasons, we would oppose the longstanding change. My recollection is this provision has been part of Oregon law since I started practicing in 1981, and I think it's sensible that, in fact, when there is a judgment entered on a contract between two parties who have negotiated a rate, that that rate should continue until the contract is fully paid, unless the contract provides for a different provision. I mean, if contracts provide that it'll change rates at the time of judgment, of course, that should be enforced as well. Thank you. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Marquis, representing the Oregon Collectors Association. We also oppose this bill, Senate Bill 516, for all of the reasons that Mr. Cosgrove has delineated here, and I won't repeat what he said. Two other issues that I would like to touch on. The language in lines 27-28 that Paul talked about, say, except for a loan described in subsection 3 of this section, if the contract bears more than 9% interest, then it shall be reduced to 9%. Sub 3 allows loans under $50,000 to be, you can have up to 12% in those loans. So theoretically, if I made a loan under $50,000, that was at 12%, it would stay at 12% post-judgment under this bill. However, if you look on line 7 of page 2, sub 3 starts off by saying, except as provided in ORS 82025. Well, 025 has a whole list of exceptions to sub 3 for various kinds of lenders that are allowed to charge more than 12%. And so the effect of this would be that if you are subject to Section 3 and made a loan of 12%, it would stay at 12% post-judgment. But if you were one of those lenders exempted under 025, I believe that then your 12% loan would have to be reduced to 9%. So it's kind of an odd, in a way, not very congruent. And I think the committee would do well to at least look at that and see if that inconsistency might cause you the same concerns that it caused us. And I would just finish by saying that this whole issue of risk, I guess, I think we need to think about the policy. People who borrow money and are a higher risk for the lender generally pay a higher interest rate. And if this bill were to become law, people who borrowed money at 12 or 14% and made all of their payments on time and paid the loan off would have paid 12 or 14% for the money they borrowed. But those folks who didn't pay the money back would have their interest reduced to 9%. That seems with that, I'll close and be happy to answer any questions.
All right, questions.
Senator Wissett first.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair Brzezinski. Jim, when you seek a court judgment to collect a loan, does that terminate the contract because otherwise it would seem that this bill, and it's kind of confusing to read, but it would seem that this bill in many instances would reduce the interest rate that is set in the contract. And I don't believe that that's a constitution. I believe it's in direct violation of the Constitution to for the both the Oregon Constitution and the federal Constitution for a legislative body to enact a bill or a law that will impair an existing contract.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, Mr. Cosgrove raised that very point, and I think there was some concern, I think, from Mr. Sears as well, that this could have some constitutional issues regarding impairment of contract. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm going to leave that to the lawyers, but I think it's a valid point that we need to at least look at that and make sure that we're not causing constitutional problems here. I mean, it seems to me that if you are modifying a contract, particularly one that's already been entered to and agreed to by the parties, that's an issue that needs to be looked at.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I think it's a valid concern. There's even a different one beyond that that I'd just like to point out. I should have mentioned this originally. The exemptions in 82025 that Mr. Marquis mentioned that the 12% won't apply to, it'll be back down to 9, include federally regulated institutions, include HUD lenders, include agencies of the United States. I don't think we have the authority to modify the rate of interest for those entities post or pre-judgment, frankly. And it, as written, it attempts to do that, at least for the post-judgment part of the interest rate. The contract after judgment survives except to the extent it's replaced by the judgment. The judgment determines how much is due and owing, so you now look to the judgment for that piece. But the other terms and provisions, for example, what security interests might, what property might secure the loan, those survive the judgment.
Any other questions, comments? All right, I'm just going to put a couple of things out. It would seem to me, first of all, if the bill was going to go forward, it needs work. Second of all, it seems to me that if you're actually going to have this go into effect, the effective date would be for contracts that are entered on or after, and anything that was prior to that time, even lines of credits or whatever, those are continual, at least how they've been defined. So, I mean, that would be part of the stuff. And then I think the other part that the chair would be interested in is what is the practice throughout the land as to what other states have done, if anything, in this area as compared to what's before us. And I do see some issues that have been brought up. Other questions or comments for anyone in the panels?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on 516? All right, before I close that public hearing, for those who are interested in this, I would suggest that you do as you said, try to get interested parties together, see what, if anything, can be worked out, and be able to address the issues that have been brought up by the opponents. Anything else? All right, we're going to close the public hearing on 516, and I believe that takes care of our work for today, and we're scheduled to be back here tomorrow at 8:30, and with that, we're adjourned.